Pronounced Houston, sir, just Houston. Like the city.
All right, Mr. Houston.
May it please the court. Congress created the RFS hardship exemption as a safety valve for small refineries just like the petitioners here. But after the change in administrations, EPA set out to eliminate that form of hardship relief that Congress created because it disagrees with Congress's policy. EPA ignored the statutory deadline to decide each of these hardship petitions within 90 days of their own filing, deciding some of the petitions years late.
And so how many have been denied? How many have been considered and how many have been denied?
For the petitioners at issue here, Your Honor, so there's six refineries that are present in this case. They are here with a series of petitions. This is best described in the chart that's at page 23 and 24 of our brief. We're talking principally about the compliance years 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020. Some petitioners have 21 petitions. But the key point to answer Your Honor's question is EPA denied them all. EPA found that nobody gets hardship relief, even though these refineries had previously received hardship relief in the past. These are exactly the kinds of companies that Congress created the safety valve to protect because they're different from other types of refineries in the market. They have structural challenges that mean that the burden of complying with the RFS is much more difficult for them than it is for example, some of the largest multinational oil companies in the world. And that
is— Your argument is that Congress intended just the opposite.
Precisely right, Your Honor. Exactly. Congress, the statutory standard in Section 7545.09b is whether the refinery can show disproportionate economic hardship from compliance with the RFS. Now, before, under the old way of EPA's approach to these types of petitions, there was a scoring matrix developed by the Department of Energy. When that matrix was in effect, that's how these companies made their business decisions back in 2017, back in 2018, back in 2019. They looked at the governing legal standard that EPA had always used and what was—
But then the EPA didn't even look at that scoring matrix.
Once they stopped denying
the petition.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. Once the change in administrations happened, once EPA decided that it doesn't like RFS hardship exemptions and it wants them all to be killed, it instructed DOE to stop scoring the petition. So we don't have the scores as of 2020. We do have scores for some of the other years, and DOE recommended that EPA grant relief. So I think that's just yet more evidence that under the prior framework, these companies would have gotten relief. And that's because all of the same structural challenges that they have faced in the past, they continue to face. Let me just give the court one example, if I might. The diesel disparity. EPA's new approach to deciding hardship exemptions is focused on looking at the market to blend ethanol into gasoline. But the refineries before you today, small refineries, produce overwhelmingly diesel product, not gasoline. That is, by the way, Ergon Refinery, one of the petitioners, produces exclusively diesel. EPA has never studied whether its new economic hypothesis is true for diesel fuel. It just asserts it. I mean, I think that's stunning that the agency could attempt to paint with such a broad brush and say, but not even actually do the work of engaging with the fundamentally different market for diesel. Why is diesel different? Because there's very little market demand for biodiesel, because the customers who buy diesel fuel for their machines need diesel. They don't want it blended. And so it is not possible to blend enough biodiesel at the rates that would achieve compliance. That means that these petitioners have no choice. They cannot accomplish the RFS obligation by blending. They are at the mercy of the market. They must go out into the market and buy the RIN trading credits.
But of course, what relief do you seek specifically?
Thank you, Your Honor. I ask the court to vacate EPA's decisions denying hardship relief.
On all of these?
Well,
100% of all these individual decisions.
For these refineries, for the six that are before the court today, Your Honor. Yes, these are individual petitions submitted by each refinery for itself. EPA denied them all. The court, I would respectfully should vacate those denial decisions, but then it needs to remand with some instructions to EPA. And the reason I say that is that we know that if the court doesn't give instructions to EPA, we know what EPA is going to do because they've already done it. Because in the meantime that we've been litigating this case, there have been more petitions for more years, and EPA has denied them too. And what it has said in its most recent round of adjudications is, we're going to continue to rest on the exact same conclusions that are before the court today. So
what instructions do you seek?
I appreciate that. I think the court should say that EPA, because it has been so consistently late in adjudicating these hardship petitions, right? There's a 90-day statutory deadline to decide each petition. EPA has blown by it again and again and again. Because EPA has been late, the obligation under basic principles of administrative law is to either grant the petition, so the court should remand with instructions to EPA to either grant the petitions or come up with an alternative form of relief that would appropriately mitigate the hardship that our clients now face. We have a ready-made solution for that.
Attention to a closely related but somewhat distinct inquiry. If we granted the, you could say the full relief that you seek here today, what is the reach of that impact? And I ask that question in view of the fact that these denial actions, as my notes says, 36 small refineries located in 18 states and the geographical boundaries of 8 different circuit courts. These have gone to the D.C. circuits, every one of them. All the others have. The Ninth Circuit dismissed, which has the effect of doing that. We are dealing with a declaration by the agency that the rule is statewide and nationwide effect. Why shouldn't this go to the D.C. Circuit? It strikes me as I listen to your argument that we're going to have a very fragmented response to this, reaching into one piece of this. When you argue that this is a single, separate matter, and I've stated another way, on its face, it cries out for a single response, and the agency says has said so. That's my question.
So I appreciate that, Judge Higginbotham. I respectfully disagree that it cries out for a nationwide response. And the reason why I say that is that the statutory text requires that the court and the agency look at the individual economic circumstances facing each refinery. I think the statutory text, with all respect, shows exactly the opposite. These are supposed to be local decisions that are based on the individual circumstances. The hardship relief turns on things, for example, like TSAR's ability, their inability to acquire RINs based at the volume, based on the amount of their volume of production. It turns on things like Placid's competition in the Chicago market. It turns on things like Wynnewood's specific contracts to buy and sell fuel in its market. So these are all things that happen here in the Fifth Circuit. And we are petitioning,
The agency said that there were two determinations. It's new interpretation of the Clean Air Act's disproportionate hardship provision, and its economic analysis of the nationwide markets for RINs. The Fifth is being asked to stand alone and against all the other circuits, and you have this determination, and all the rest of the determinations are going to be made by the D.C. Circuit.
So, respectfully, Your Honor, it's not all other determinations. The 11th Circuit has pending.
It's not all the circuits. It's the 3rd, 7th, 10th, and the 9th.
I certainly grant that several circuits have transferred these to the D.C. Circuit. The D.C. Circuit will weigh in on these issues. The 11th Circuit, we hope, will also weigh in on them as well. The reason why this court should weigh in under the court's precedent approaching Section 7607, the venue statute, is that the court has said it is going to look at what are the determinations that lie at the core of the decision and what is the action under this chapter, to quote the statutory text, that Congress authorized the agency to take. I think that the statutory text here is perfectly clear that the action that Congress authorized was an individual decision that must be based and was based on each refinery's individual circumstances. Now, Your Honor referenced the fact that the EPA came up with a new economic hypothesis. It did, but it was just that. It was a hypothesis. EPA said, we have a new theory about the experience of these refineries. And then it had to test it. It did not just stop there. If the EPA had said, we want to proceed by rulemaking, and we're going to set out a new adjudicatory framework for RFS hardship exemptions, and they're going to do, you know, a rulemaking, that would have to go to the DC Circuit. I agree. But EPA didn't do that. They made a choice to proceed by adjudication. Why? Because, of course, they know that there's no way that they could meet the standard for retroactivity with a rulemaking. So in order to go back and adjudicate in 2018 petitions and make decisions in 2022, EPA had to choose to proceed by adjudication, not rulemaking. And that choice has consequences. And one of the key consequences of that choice is that the EPA's application of its new hypothesis, when it went out and tested that by looking at the individual economic circumstances of each refinery, that was an individualized decision. You can see this in EPA's own description of its action. It says it, quote, carefully reviewed the data, contracts, and other information submitted by each refinery to determine their RIN costs. That's the denial decision at page 26.
Counsel, we can't just say, well, this other circuit did this, and so we should do it too, because those other circuits don't have the robust venue precedent that we have, do they?
I completely agree with that, Your Honor. I think
we have to follow our precedent.
Absolutely you do, Your Honor. And of course, the court's precedents in the Texas case in 2016 that's discussed at length in our brief, I think this court actually has one of the most robust bodies of precedent on the application of the venue provision of the Clean Air Act.
I mean, the D.C. Circuit's written about our robust some of the judges there, haven't they, about our robust venue precedent?
I absolutely agree with that, Judge Elrod. And I think that the fundamental principle, as I read this court's cases discussing venue, the key question, the court says, is you have to first focus on the action under this chapter, because that's the statutory phrase. And you go look at the relevant provision of the Clean Air Act, and you ask, what decision is EPA charged with making? And when you look at the provision that applies here, the decision that EPA is charged with making is a decision that must be based on each individual refinery's economic circumstances. And as I just read to the court, I think EPA acknowledges that that's the kind of decision that they made.
Counsel, we haven't discussed the alternative form of relief still. It's not clear to me what that would be.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. So I think the best, EPA has a ready-made solution to this problem. And just to say one sentence about what that problem is, we are here in 2023 talking about the compliance years 2017, 2018, 2019. You can't unscramble that egg. We can't go back in time and manufacture and blend more fuel in 2023. We can't go back and buy RINs. They don't exist. The RINs have a 1 and 2 year total shelf life. And RINs for 2018 just don't exist anymore, and EPA knows it. So EPA created a solution, the alternative compliance demonstration approach, that they issued. This was EPA's creation for the 2018 year, and what they said is, we're going to enable these refineries to demonstrate their compliance without retiring RINs. That's the obvious solution. I'm not attempting to tell the court that that is the only possible solution that's legally available.
Isn't that reaching out more? It's more in the business of the EPA rather than just this simple grant.
So I think all I'm trying to suggest is that I think the court should tell EPA it should either grant or do the alternative compliance demonstration.
Oh, let the EPA choose.
I think it should choose, but I think its choices must be limited to one of those two things. If I might just say one more sentence about the ACDA, because there's an important caveat, which is that Wynnewood, one of the petitioners here, really, for Wynnewood, the ACDA does not go far enough for reasons that my colleague is going to explain in the next case. And so as to Wynnewood, we would need the ACDA to really go even farther. Just because of the unusual circumstances there.
Now, the EPA says that your clients should have prepared for the possible denial of the petitions and pre-purchased these RINs or RINs. Is there a reason that you don't believe that's true?
Yes, Your Honor, there's three reasons, and I appreciate the opportunity to address them. The first is that the refineries couldn't buy RINs ratably, as the record shows. Most of them didn't have the financial ability. They would have gone insolvent while waiting for EPA to comply with the deadline, while waiting for EPA to sit on these petitions that it adjudicated long after the statutory deadline. Some of them, like TSAR, couldn't buy small lots of RINs that match their small production volume. Of course, keep in mind, these are small refineries. They're not like the big players in the market that go out and buy these things en masse. They can't buy at that level. So that's one reason. They couldn't do it, as EPA knows. Second, The parties that actually, a couple of parties actually attempted it. But when they did, they incurred massive business losses. So they took, if you might think of it as sort of an ultra-conservative approach, they said, we believe we're entitled to hardship relief, but just in case EPA denies us, we're gonna go out in the market and buy RINs, and we're gonna retire them. Well, what happened? When they bought those RINs, they retired them. Then EPA decides, they grant the hardship petitions. They say, we agree, you're entitled to your hardship exception. Here are your RINs back. But those RINs are now either worthless or substantially devalued because you can't go out and sell them. Nobody wants them anymore. It's too late. Again, because EPA has decided these things way too late. When Wynnewood attempted this, when it attempted to buy RINs all along and then got them back, it lost $19 million in a single year. Placid, another one of the refineries here, did the same thing. It lost $7 million. So this was an incredibly risky strategy. It's not just like playing it safe. The companies who risk this face massive business losses. The GAO report also describes this in detail.
But can we consider the GAO report since it's post-dates?
So respectfully, I disagree with that, Your Honor. I'm not trying to suggest that. It's true that the court couldn't say that EPA broke the law by failing to consider the GAO report. But that's not my argument. My point is GAO looked at the exact same evidence that was before the agency, the same body of evidence that's before this court. And what GAO concluded essentially is that the EPA acted with a faulty process and reached incorrect conclusions. I think the court should treat the GAO report like the conclusion of another court looking at the same issues. It should just give it sort of the respectful attention for what it's worth. It's persuasive authority that explains, it confirms the problems that we're identifying here. But even if you don't want to look at the GAO report, the actual evidence in the record about these clients describes the point I was just making, that they face massive business losses if they tried to take the conservative approach. And then the last point about that, the last reason it just didn't make any sense, put yourself in the position of running a business in 2018, if I might ask the court to do that. You have consistently received hardship relief. You know that all the factors that have been the basis for EPA's decision that you're exempt in the past are just as bad or getting worse. The burdens of the RFS are growing every single year, as DOE predicted they would back in 2011. Does it make sense to say we're going to go out, notwithstanding the fact that we've been exempt in the past and all of everything is just as bad as it was before, we're going to go out and spend tens of millions of dollars or more on RINs? The obligations that we're talking about here are enormous. For Wynnewood, for one of the petitioners, for just 1 year, the RIN obligation is imposed by EPA is $150 million. That is not the kind of cash that a small refinery just has laying around to go and make that kind of decision. So I think for all those reasons, for EPA to come and say, you should have anticipated that we were going to fundamentally remake the standard, the rules of the game by which we decide these petitions, just doesn't cut it under administrative law.
The briefing seems to have the flavor that EPA is not just making bad decisions for these small refineries, but that EPA actively doesn't want the small refineries. Is the briefing supposed to give that flavor?
I think the record of EPA's actions is what shows that, Your Honor. I think what we have seen is that when the administration changed, the agency dramatically changed its approach to hardship exemptions.
That's a policy decision that's not in our pay grade, or do you think it is relevant because of Congress's instructions in this regard?
The latter. I'm not trying to tell the court of, EPA can have whatever policy it likes, of course, but what it must do is follow the law. And the legal state, and that comes up in two ways. Number one, it has to faithfully apply the disproportionate economic hardship standard that Congress set out. I think it's very telling that the bottom line conclusion of the EPA's decision that we are challenging here is, notwithstanding the statutory text, no refinery should have ever received hardship relief in the past, and no refinery ever will again in the future. That is not an agency, in my view, that is faithfully applying the statutory standard that Congress set out. And we know from the Supreme Court's decision in Holly Frontier that, contrary to the EPA's argument, Congress wanted these hardship exemptions to continue to be an important part of the overall RFS program, and that's because they are a safety valve. Congress recognized that the burden of this enormous obligation was going to fall differently on the smallest oil refineries as opposed to the largest multinational integrated oil refineries. That's the whole point of the statute existing. And again, the factors that EPA has consistently looked to when it has applied this program, things like diesel, things like the fact that some of these refineries ship their products through pipelines that don't permit blended fuel. Those are the kinds of localized determinations that have led the agency in the past to say, we recognize you're going to be disproportionately burdened and you're entitled to hardship relief. Those are the exact same factors that these refineries continue to face today. And they are, to your point, Judge Higginbotham, the reasons why these are fundamentally local determinations, not a national determination. The agency needed to look at the pipeline in which you ship, the contracts that you make in your own legalized market. And you can see the agency doing that. I think if the court looks at JA 3647, 3385, 3488, 3818, and 3974, those are the refinery-specific decisions where EPA is talking to each refinery about its own economic circumstances, as it was required to do by the Clean Air Act. I want to say just one more word, if I might, about what's sort of fundamentally wrong with EPA's decision here. The premise of EPA's new economic hypothesis, the pass-through hypothesis, it only holds on EPA's own account if all parties in the market pay the same costs for RINs. EPA tells us that. But we know that premise is false. The GAO restudied it and said, that's not true. It doesn't seem consistent with the data that we're looking at. EPA responded to that with their own RIN price analysis, as we describe in the brief. And they say, you're right. They say, we now acknowledge that small refineries have to pay more for RINs to buy them, and they get to sell them for less. This, by the way, should not be surprising under basic principles of economics. We're talking about the smallest refineries. They have much less bargaining power. They don't set the market. They have to follow it. They sometimes get squeezed. That's just how markets work.
But on that point, the agency stated that, as I recall, that the denial actions were based on two determinations. It's new determination of the CAA's disproportionate hardship provision, and the economic analysis of the nationwide market for RINs, the nationwide markets for RINs. Is that correct?
Your Honor, what they had was a hypothesis that everybody in the nationwide market pays the same amount. They then tested it. They went out and looked. They did a study on it. They did two relevant studies. The first one is the RIN price analysis that I was just mentioning, where they came through and said, actually, contrary to what we said before, we now acknowledge that small refineries have to pay a little bit more. They have to sell for a little bit less. EPA says, well, maybe that's just noise in the data. The differences are small. Of course, the differences aren't that small. You're talking about up to 7.5% in some cases. And even small percentage differences make a huge difference when you're talking about tens of millions of RINs. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing was they needed to test their hypothesis by looking at the individual submission. So again, it's just a hypothesis. We then submitted to them record evidence and said, I know you have this hypothesis, but here's our proof that we don't pass through our RIN costs, that our costs to buy and sell RINs are not the same as everyone else's in the market. And EPA sort of just shrugs that off and says, well, maybe that's aberrational. Maybe those contracts are unusual. That's their response to Placid's contracts. Placid put its contracts in the record. So here's the proof that we get squeezed when we try to buy RINs. EPA said, those contracts seem unusual. That's the whole point of the disproportionate economic hardship exemption that Congress created. So I think what you see here is that the agency decision relies on false premises, the premise is that everybody pays the same for RINs, the premise that refineries are able to buy RINs ratably, as I was discussing earlier with Judge Elrod. You see that the agency ignored an important aspect of the problem, the diesel disparity, the fact that these companies produce diesel, but EPA never even seriously studied the diesel problem. Those are classic administrative law failures. They cry out for the agency to instruction from this court to go back and take their obligation seriously to study the actual impact of this program on small refineries in the real world. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Houston. You've saved some time for rebuttal. Mr. Hughes.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Jeffrey Hughes from the Department of Justice on behalf of EPA. With me at counsel's table is my colleagues Brian Harrison from the Department of Justice and Susan Staley from EPA. I will be addressing points 1 and 2 from our brief, venue and retroactivity. My colleague, Mr. Harrison, will be addressing points 3 and 4, statutory interpretation and record-based analysis. First, under this court's cases, venue is proper in the D.C. Circuit, and this court should dismiss these petitions in favor of those currently pending in the D.C. Circuit. First, the denial actions are nationally applicable. The denial actions apply a common, nationwide analytical framework to refineries in 18 states stretching from West Virginia to Hawaii and in 8 federal judicial circuits.
This case is saying that they're not dependent on the individual facts of a given refinery in the Fifth Circuit or anywhere else.
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that on the face of the action, which is what this court's decision in Texas 2016 says should be looked to in determining whether a decision is nationally applicable, and what the court says in Texas 2011, that it applies absolutely to the refineries throughout the country. And so that's the analysis there, and that's consistent with not only this court's decisions, but also the decisions of the 10th Circuit and ATK launch systems, and the 7th Circuit in Southern Illinois Power Cooperative. Moreover, as this court concluded in Texas 2011, Congress intended the DC Circuit to review matters on which national uniformity is desirable.
So it's confusing to me what you're saying, because doesn't your brief say that EPA considered individual refinery information in making its determination, that individual refinery information is very much part of what it's supposed to consider and what it says it did consider? And doesn't your brief say that in the merits briefing in this case?
Judge Elrod, EPA absolutely considered individual information from the refineries, but I would submit that.
You're saying it's not relevant?
I'm saying the question is whether an action is nationally applicable. The question is, where does it apply? And here, it applies from West Virginia to Hawaii. It applies across the nation on its face. And all of the cases say that you look to the face of the action. So that's what I would say. Second, though, if the court disagreed with me that this action was not nationally applicable, this dismissal in favor of the petitions pending in the D.C. Circuit would still be appropriate, because EPA based its action on multiple determinations of nationwide scope or effect. And that is including its analysis of the RIN market, including that refineries recover the cost of the RIN every time they sell a gallon of diesel or other fuel, that each RIN is the same priced, and that the cost of acquiring RINs is the same for all parties, and that the RFS obligation is the same for every gallon of gasoline and diesel fuel. Now, Judge Elrod, just because there are some individual local determinations does not mean that this is not a case based on a determination of nationwide scope or effect. What 7607B says is that it applies to locally or regionally applicable actions that are based on determinations of nationwide scope or effect. So of course there are going to be some local or regionally applicable elements of that. It can't be that because there are bottom line conclusions that are locally or regionally applicable, that the case has to be in the regional circuit.
If the principle of nationwide uniformity is overriding, then there would never be venue anywhere other than in the D.C. Circuit, because to the extent that any circuit makes other determinations, that would destroy the uniformity that you say is overriding.
I think perhaps I wasn't clear earlier, Your Honor. What my point here is just that national uniformity is
particularly appropriate in circumstances like this, where it deals with EPA's new statutory analysis and its nationwide analysis of the RIN and fuel markets. You know, EPA in the past has not suggested, and that's on the nationally applicable prong of 7607B, not on the determinations based on actions based on determinations of nationwide scope or effect. So, you know, in the past, EPA has not taken the position that single analysis, you know, a single refinery determination in a single circuit is nationally applicable. Or similarly, in the Texas 2016 decision, EPA did not take the position that that SIPs in just Texas and Oklahoma were nationally applicable.
Is it still theoretically possible for an exemption to be granted?
Your Honor, that is a question I'm going to leave to my colleague, Mr. Harrison.
Well, that's relevant, because then it would depend upon the specifics, and that would be the determining force, would be the specifics. And so it's not so... That's relevant to the venue question.
Well, Your Honor, what 7607B says is that it has to be based on determinations of nationwide scope or effect. And there are certainly determinations, the reasons the agency gave for its action, that are based on determinations of nationwide scope or effect here, including particularly the analysis of the RIN and the fuel markets.
Now, so is it possible for any of these refineries to get the exemption? Any of the refineries in this lawsuit, the six refineries at issue, can they, going forward, ever get an exemption?
They would need to demonstrate, Your Honor, that they are not able to pass on their RIN costs, that the EPA's nationwide analysis of the RIN market does not apply to them.
Didn't the GAO report already demonstrate that?
Your Honor, the GAO report should not be considered here. It's a post-decisional document, not before the agency. And
didn't the agency's own materials discuss the economics of the GAO report that said, oh, yes, it's true that these things aren't actually the same price in every market?
Your Honor, Mr. Harrison is better positioned to address these reports, but I would just reiterate, these are post-decisional documents that were not before the agency at the time. Mr. Houston said that they could be considered for their persuasive value. I'm not aware of any.
Is that why you normally would expect an agency to do notice and comment rulemaking if it's going to change the way that it applies the statute? That you would, and so you would get all that baked in and know whether this was a good decision by the EPA or not?
Your Honor, we did take comment on this issue. There was a notice in December of 2021. All of the petitioners took the opportunity to.
But it wasn't a rulemaking.
It wasn't a rulemaking, but.
And it's a new rule that says that everything we've done, past and future, is no good.
It's a new interpretation, Your
it's
Honor.
It's a pretty broadest interpretation I've ever. Seems like a new rule.
It's a new interpretation, Your Honor, but it's not. But it's not the case that petitioners can point to a binding standard that was in place prior to this.
You could have been in the D.C. Circuit for sure if you'd have done this as a rulemaking, right?
Certainly we could have, but we can also be on the D.C. Circuit here, Your Honor. I think to answer your question from earlier about whether petitioners can ever demonstrate it again, to the extent they can demonstrate that they are not able to pass on their RIN costs, then we think they can.
Okay, and we are not asking us to defer to EPA's decisions about whether it's nationwide or not, because that's not appropriate for us to do.
No, Your Honor, as I understand this court's analysis in Texas 2016, that the court will determine whether it's nationwide scope, whether it's nationally applicable.
And in this one, did we carry it, or did we?
It was carried. It was initially granted in favor of EPA and transferred to the D.C. Circuit, and then on reconsideration.
It's the other one that has the more robust.
Sorry?
Nothing. We'll get it to in the other case.
Okay.
Thanks.
But, Your Honor, I just want to reiterate, it can't be that just because there are some local determinations that the regional circuit has venue here. That's always going to be the case in an action that is locally or regionally applicable, and to so hold would render that provision surplusage.
But likewise, the counter would render its surplusage, if any time that it did affect the national policy, it belonged in D.C., then every single one would belong in D.C. because you could make an argument that that's affecting the national. So it's the two sides of the same coin.
Well, Your Honor,
so that's why it has to be a.
In Texas 2020, this court said that it is, you know, as long as EPA has made a determination taken an action based on a determination of nationwide scope or effect, EPA has the discretion to choose the venue. That is what Texas 2020 says, and that if it has made such a determination, it can either have a venue in the circuit courts or in the D.C. Circuit, and that that decision is unreviewable by EPA.
Well, the provision for referring cases to the D.C. Circuit, last time I looked, was an act of Congress. It's not an assertion by a claim of a power by an agency. It is a power conferred by the Congress upon the administrative agency. I think that obvious fact is the backdrop by which to look at this thing. Congress, as I read the statute and the interpretations of it, provided for circumstances under which you have economic impact that reverberates across the country, whatever. But it left that initial decision for nationwide effect to be decided or not to be reviewed by the D.C. Circuit, not because of preferences one particular circuit over another, but to get a single determination.
That's
the way I read it. Now, my colleague is correct. It's been a lot of interpretation of that, but I do think that that's the foundational point that needs to be, in my thinking, kept in mind. This is not a grab of power by the administrative state. It is rather a power conferred by the Congress. As a threshold matter, that doesn't answer
that's
the
absolutely,
question. But
that's absolutely right, Judge.
I'm sure about it. The other thing, observation I make for you, I think it's useful to keep in mind, is that if you forgive an old antitrust lawyer observation, when the government reaches in and tries to regulate the pushes and shoves of a market, it's got its hands full. Now, that may be a kind of a West Texas observation about it, but it is fundamental. So it's a delicate, difficult problem to do if you were trying to regulate local markets. And that's part of the difficulty here with the detailed instructions with the RINs, et cetera, et cetera. So some people want protections for the free market.
I would just add, Your Honors, on this venue point that though petitioner's challenge doesn't drive the action, it's clear that from their submissions that their central issues are national. Their briefs focus on whether EPA has acted retroactively and has interpreted the CAA properly, and those arguments predominate in the briefs. I see I'm almost out of time. Just quickly on retroactivity, if the court reaches the merits, it should reject petitioner's claim that EPA acted retroactively.
What is the status of those other cases that have been transferred?
The D.C. Circuit has consolidated the cases. Petitioner's brief has been filed. EPA's brief is due next week.
And what's the expected timetable? What's the expected timetable for argument?
There's no argument set right now, Your Honor. The 11th Circuit argument has been held. It was held over the summer. The D.C. Circuit argument hasn't been set, and petitioner's reply brief is due in the next few months.
Next few months?
Yes. I apologize. I don't have the date off the top of my head on when the reply brief is due. It's due before the end of the year, if I'm correct.
It doesn't have to be done within a really short time period after the first brief, the second brief. Never mind. It just seems.
You started with your first sentence about retroactivity. You can have two more sentences on retroactivity if you want to use that.
Thank you, Your Honor. Quick points on retroactivity. All of the exemption petitions were pending at the time EPA issued these denials, and so there's no retroactive effect here. It didn't impair vested rights or increase liability. Second, even if it did have a retroactive effect, that effect is permissible because petitioners could not have relied on EPA's prior interpretations. They don't cite anything that suggests that this was a fixed standard.
There's one reference to a statement in the record that says that EPA has relied on the DOE matrix in order to affect consultation, but it has never been EPA's position that it must mechanically apply the matrix. You can see that in the cases like Sinclair, where DOE recommended denial. Okay.
And thank you, Mr. Hughes. Mr. Harrison.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Brian Harrison, also with the Justice Department, on behalf of EPA. I'll be discussing the statutory interpretation and reasonableness of EPA's action. But first, Judge Elrod, to your questions about the status of the DC Circuit briefing, our brief is due on October 11th. The reply brief is due on December 20th, and final briefs are due on January 10th.
Thank you.
Before I get into the substance of my discussion, I do want to directly address the questions that you asked of Mr. Houston and the comments made about this being an economic hypothesis. This is not an economic hypothesis. This is an economic principle that five of the petitioners have challenged in the DC Circuit in 2018 and lost in the Alon decision. In that case, the DC Circuit affirmed EPA's decision to apply the RIN discount and the RIN cost pass-through economic principles and found that EPA had substantially justified those economic principles. But what we have here is even more than that. Since that time, EPA has taken the foundation for that decision and conducted additional analysis, gathered additional market data, and gathered information from each of the small refineries at issue in this case, and small refineries generally, as well as other stakeholders, and conducted additional analysis of those economic principles and confirmed them through its analysis. And that's explained in the denial action at length. There are pages upon pages of formulas and tables and charts that analyze that information that shows a few key points. One is that the obligations under the Renewable Fuel Standards Program are the same for every gallon of fuel that's produced, whether it's diesel or whether it's gasoline. And I would like to briefly, on that point, explain the diesel point. EPA directly addressed that in the denial action. We discuss it at our brief at pages 50 and 67 through 71. In the denial action itself, there are tables and charts and formulas directly related to diesel and the analysis that EPA did on diesel. EPA determined that the RFS places the same obligations on gas and diesel, and also found and used external studies to conclude that the costs that are passed through function similarly for gas and diesel, not only with that distinction, but also for different geographic regions and different refineries based on their size.
If it matters on different geographic reasons and different refineries based upon their size, then why isn't that a regional decision?
Well, again, I would defer to my colleague, Mr. Hughes' explanation on that. I think that his answer covered that as well.
Well, then the next question I have is, does it tell you that there is a market for blended diesel in the region?
I believe that the denial action
chart say that? Or some other parts say, yes, there is indeed a market in the Chicago area, or you know, the different areas for blended diesel, which is a unique product.
There is analysis in the denial action related to different geographic markets as it relates to the different fuel products. And so
the EPA has determined that you can sell blended diesel, that if you can make it?
EPA determined that the costs of compliance are the same for someone who is blending diesel as any other obligated party under the Renewable Fuel Standards Program. And the reason that they concluded that is because of one of the economic principles that the Alon case in the DC Circuit upheld, and that's the RIN cost pass-through, where the costs of these compliance obligations are passed through to the wholesale purchaser or the retail purchaser.
But so, they're not in these small refineries because it was shown they couldn't even buy or sell at the good prices. we have experimental evidence on one of these refineries.
Well, so Judge Elrod, respectfully, EPA urged and invited these small refineries to submit information after the proposed denial to disprove its economic principles here. Many of the small refineries submitted that type of information. EPA analyzed it and found that in many instances, the information that was provided, for example, a pricing contract, demonstrated the RIN discount and the RIN cost pass-through theories. They looked at those documents and found that those existed for those small refineries. And I think an important point to note here on that as well is EPA's actions were reasonable and they're entitled to substantial deference. This is within EPA's expertise. And so for petitioners to come in and claim that the action was arbitrary and capricious, they need to do more than just disagree with EPA's findings, which is what they're doing here. EPA meaningfully engaged with the information and data that was provided to it in order to make these determinations.
Does the EPA disagree with the DOE and the GAO on these issues, these economic issues?
Well, so I'll take those in turn, Judge Elrod. The first on the GAO report, it should not be considered before this court. It's post-decisional and it's extra record. The D.C. Circuit, in affirming EPA's extension rule in July, disregarded the GAO report for that very basis. But even then, the GAO report is of limited probative value here. And the reason why is it didn't even study small refineries. It studied smaller parties. And in EPA's response to the GAO report, they explained why that was significant. Not all small parties to RIN transactions are small refineries. And so by not studying the specifics of small refineries, the GAO report itself even conceded that it's at 2822, unclear the extent to which this, the not considering small refineries, materially affects small refineries. And so on top of that, the GAO report had incorrect assumptions about weighted scales for the RIN transactions and made incorrect market assumptions. But at the end of the day, EPA went back and recrunched the numbers based on GAO's assumptions and found that the price that a small refinery might pay could be more, or it could be less in some instances as well. And even if it
depends
was
on the region?
I'm sorry?
Depends on the region?
It depends on a lot of factors that were outside of the scope of the GAO report itself. But what that does show is that even at the 1.2% difference that EPA calculated, 1.2% is not disproportionate economic hardship as required under the statute itself.
Aren't these refineries just hanging on barely, and they'd be out of business they're barely hanging on as it is?
Well, Judge Elrod, I think EPA is certainly sympathetic to that point. However, the RFS compliance obligations aren't the cause of those sorts of harms. Based on EPA's economic principles, the costs of these compliance are passed on through the RIN cost pass-through when a obligated party sells a gallon of fuel. And so in their hand, they have the cost of compliance that they can then take to the RIN marketplace and buy a RIN to demonstrate compliance. And so the fact that these small refineries didn't take the money that they received from that transaction that included the price of the RIN and go buy a RIN on the marketplace, that's a business decision that they make. That has nothing to do with their RFS compliance obligations or the hardship that would be imposed.
Well, one of them did, and they faced, and it was a total bad decision on terms of the buying the RINs.
Well, I would dispute the characterization of how that process went,
saying a bad decision in complying with the regulation. That's not what I'm saying financially. I'm only analyzing it that way.
Sure. And I think to that point too, it's important to note that there are remedies available to small refineries in unusual situations where there may be anomalies in retiring RINs or things like that.
Okay, well then does that mean that could a refinery ever get a hardship under the new method that the EPA has decided should have been the method used all along?
Yes, and here's why.
But none has.
Not to this point.
Okay, how could they do it?
So the EPA has explained the factors by which, or the metrics by which that could be done. It was in the proposed denial. EPA said to the small refineries, this is what we need. Show us that our economic principles are wrong here. For example, here's an example. If a small refinery were to come in and say, here's a contract that shows I pay $2 for every RIN, and then they would say, but the market on these dates shows that the cost of the RINs only costs $1. Therefore, I'm paying $2 to comply rather than $1 for the rest of the obligated parties. And so in an instance like that, that would be, I can't speak for EPA, but I think that would be an example of where a small refinery has demonstrated.
You can't speak for the EPA?
Well, I can't say that if that was the, hypothetical that EPA would grant the decision, but certainly that would be sufficient, I would think, to justify that there is disproportionate economic costs or disproportionate economic hardship based on the costs of compliance.
And that would be in a specific place. That I have to pay this amount in this place, but it's only a dollar in two. Your example is because the way it works in that place.
So just one point generally on how that would appear. There are pricing contracts for the small refineries that itemize many of these things. So it's very clear to determine what the costs of the RINs are versus what are some of the other costs that are passed on. Judge Alright, you also asked about the 2011 DOE study. And so I do want to make mention of that. So 7545.09D2 requires that EPA consult with the Department of Energy and also consider the DOE study. And so EPA consulted with DOE on 13 occasions here and memorialized that in a consultation memo that's part of the record. EPA also considered the 2011 DOE study and has explained in the denial action itself how it considered it and why it was not why it found it not relevant for these purposes. And the reasons why is the 2011 study is more than a decade old. It relied on hypothetical information rather than the empirical data that EPA has gathered over the course of the last decade plus. It also did not consider or evaluate the impact of the RIN discount and the RIN cost pass-through. So it didn't fully consider the factors related to the economic principles underlying this decision.
Can you quickly address why did it take longer than the statutorily required 90 days and what's going on with that?
Sure. Well, the short answer of that, Your Honor, is that these cases were all backlogged and put into abeyance while the RFA case from the Tenth Circuit went to the Supreme Court in the Holly Frontier decision. And so there were remands taken after the Holly Frontier decision that EPA then went back and revisited and issued denials on.
Why were they done? Nobody required that to happen, did they?
Well, based on the issues that were, the issue that was before the Supreme Court,
So you chose to wait, and it made it late.
Well, 2 points on that. With the consent of many of the small refineries and petitioners.
These parties?
I don't know the specifics of which ones of these.
Your colleague's shaking his head. Yes, some of them may have consented.
I see that my time has expired. Judge Alright, you asked a question about remedy. If I may just make one quick point on that. What petitioners are asking for here is with the instructions on the remand is relief that's beyond the scope of the Administrative Procedures Act. And so if this court were to not find in our favor, we would ask that the court simply remand the decision so that EPA can then make its decisions based on the decision here.
Could we impose time requirements given the tremendous delay that's been taking place?
I believe you could. There have been circuit courts that have issued time requirements on EPA to act in these type. Not in the small refinery context, but in the renewable fuel standards context.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harrison. Mr. Morrison.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Matthew Morrison. I'm here on behalf of the renewable fuel interveners. I want to try to quickly address some of the points that have been raised this morning. And I want to begin, if I may, with a point of whether we're in the right court. Two quick points on that that I'd ask you to consider. The first is Section 307 of the Clean Air Act, which really speaks to this. Section 307 says that it should be in the D.C. Circuit if either the action taken by the agency has national applicability or, in the case we have here today, if the action was, quote, based on a determination of nationwide scope or effect. I don't think there's any debate that what we have has national scope and effect. These are individual actions, true, and they were looking at fact-specific, case-specific indicia, but it's still a policy, it's an interpretation with national scope or effect. Secondly, we would have as many as 9 circuit courts looking at the same issues if we were to have regional application and review. That would increase the chances of tremendous judicial inconsistency when you have 9 courts looking at the same question.
So Congress should have said that all of these go to the D.C. Circuit or to some designated circuit that Congress might have selected, right?
Right, and Congress essentially...
That's not what they did.
And Congress essentially did in Section 307 say that where the agency, where EPA is acting under the Clean Air Act in such a matter, it should be handled to ensure national consistency in the D.C. Circuit.
That's why isn't, if the EPA is using a new method, why isn't percolation helpful?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree with the premise that this is a new approach.
I thought they said that the old approach is no good and this is the approach that should have been used all along, whether it pre-existed.
There was a period in 2017, 2018, where the agency was taking a different tack and analysis, looking at small refinery exemptions. But its position on RIN cost pass-through has been around since 2009 when it did the first DOE study. It's in the record. The second one was 2015 when it did the Burkholder study, again in 2017, again in 2021. Each time EPA is receiving comment, looking at data, looking at analysis, and figuring out whether in fact it is true that the RIN costs are recovered by refineries small and large. And
isn't that an advantage of percolation?
Excuse me?
Percolation between the courts, that you get more and more information so that to be helpful to the agency and the refiners and the Congress.
That's right, Your Honor. Each time that EPA looked at the issue, it had in front of it more information, more analysis, and EPA honed its position until it came to the conclusion that, yes, in fact, the RIN costs, the RFS compliance costs, are borne the same by refiners small and large. And one of the reasons why that makes a lot of sense, because the whole RFS program is structured such that small refineries get small renewable fuel obligations and large refiners get large RFS obligations. It's inherently scaled. So if you have a program that's scaled like that, it's very difficult for one of one size to claim that they're disproportionately affected. And I also want to point out, not only is the hardship...
Carson, you can have 15 seconds more if you'd like to...
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to close by saying the hardships we talked about today are largely discussing refiners. The hardships are also borne by the American farmers and renewable fuel producers that make the renewable fuel that Congress wanted to be blended in. It's unfair also to the vast majority of refiners that pay their fair share and blend in the renewable fuel that Congress expected. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Morrison. Mr. Houston for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. A couple points. On venue, I would urge the court to take another look at its decision from the Texas 2016 case, especially Penn site page 424. The essence of this court's precedent on venue is that we look at what type of decision does the statute authorize EPA to make? What does the statute require EPA to decide at the core? That's a quote from this court's decision. And just, I think, what the court will see if it rereads that opinion and looks here is that just like in that case, quote, EPA's new legal interpretation, such as they are, cannot be divorced from the particular factual context, end quote, of the refinery-specific evidence. That was the basis of the court's decision in Texas 2016. It's exactly the same thing here. On retroactivity, we had to operate our businesses in 2018, 2019, 2020. We had to decide how much to blend, how many RINs to buy, how to run the business. We could not have predicted back in 2018 and 2019 that in April and June of 2022, well after the statutory deadline, EPA would entirely throw out the DOE scoring matrix that it had always used for these petitions and instruct the refineries for the first time to make ratable RIN purchases as they go, even though they had previously told the refineries, quote, refineries need not acquire RINs at the same time that they produce fuel. It's a complete sea change in how they have approached these things, and it's years after we can do anything about it. I want to emphasize that the stakes here really could not be higher. As we have explained, as several of the petitioners before the court explained to the court in petitioning for a stay pending review, which the court granted, it is no exaggeration to say that whether these refineries are able to survive will depend on this court's decision for at least some of them. The burden is that severe, and the precise figures, the extent of the burden in numerical terms, the hundreds of millions of dollars. It is $1 billion that EPA is trying to impose.
So the popular word nowadays is existential. Is it existential?
For some of these petitioners, yes, Judge Smith, it absolutely is. It is an existential issue facing their companies right now. On the merits, my friend brought up the D.C. Circuit's Alon refining case. I really think that case is almost nothing useful to tell you about the decision here. It was about a completely different issue, namely, who is going to be obligated to do the blending? Who is going to have the obligation? It was not about small refineries. It was not about the hardship exemption. It was about the entire RFS program back when the program was getting set up.
Did it bless the economic outcomes of the EPA?
Absolutely not, Your Honor, because the D.C. Circuit wasn't asked to study. EPA wasn't studying. The D.C. Circuit wasn't looking at the disproportionate burden that small refineries face. Alon refining and the rule that was at issue there were not about small refineries. It wasn't about the hardship exemption. It was about the entire RFS program, everybody in the whole market who produces transportation fuel. So what we have is something that's really entirely new, and it's a new conclusion that these small refineries, even though they lack market power compared to their much larger vertically integrated counterparts, they, EPA says, don't face any kind of pressure. They get to pay the same things for RINs, even though, as I think my friend acknowledged to Your Honor, they now acknowledge that there are differences in what these refineries have to pay. By contrast, the GAO report is about small refineries and the exemption, and it confirms the deficiencies in EPA's process. It reached the same conclusion we would urge this court to reach about the insufficiency of the EPA's process. My friend says that we could theoretically get the exemption. We would have to show that we don't get the full value of the RIN in our contracts. That's exactly the type of evidence that we tried to submit once EPA introduced this pass-through idea. It is in the record. We sent EPA the contracts. Placid is perhaps the best example. It literally sent its contracts to buy and sell RINs where it says, we have exactly the situation that Mr. Harrison described. We don't capture the full RIN value.
This, because they said that you could have sent this in when the denial was going on as part of the appeal of the denial, and that wasn't sent in. That the idea that these cost problems for the particular refineries.
That was in December of 2021, Your Honor, that they put this out. We're talking, again, about decisions that we had to make in 18, 19, 20 for the years at issue here.
So did you submit that or not?
We submitted it when they put us on notice in December, and they said, we have these, we would like you to hear about pass-through. We did our best to try to give them the evidence. They swatted it away, sort of gave it the back of the hand. I want to make one final point.
We were told just a few minutes ago that if we were to send this back to the agency, that it's not permissible under the statute for us to give any particular direction or instructions. Can you comment on that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I would really urge the court, when it's thinking about what instructions to give, to take a look at page 23 and 24 in our brief, which shows the timeline, the dates that the petitions were submitted, and just how late EPA has been. It has been late over 90% of the time. And the one
that wasn't my question. My question is, does the statute permit us to give specific instruction or direction rather than simply a general recommitting the case to the agency?
Yes. The reason is because the agency has been late under the D.C. Circuit's decision in Americans for Clean Energy, it has an obligation to mitigate the harm to the refinery. So that is the instruction that I think the court is authorized to give and should give. It needs to tell the agency that there are consequences for failing to follow the law. And I think what the record shows is unless this court gives this instruction, this agency is not going to respect the statutory deadline because it has shown so over and over again. So what the court should instruct the agency to do, consistent with the applicable administrative law precedent, is to follow the law going forward, to make decisions on time, and if it's late, it has to take account of the harm that it has inflicted on the petitioners from its late action and mitigate it.
But we don't have, do we have authority to grant the entire relief, to grant the exemption?
So I think, in candor, Your Honor, I don't think the court can order the agency to grant the petitions, but what I think the courts can do is say the agency needs to either grant the petitions, which would obviously make up for our harm, or it needs to impose another form of relief that would mitigate our harm, like the alternative compliance demonstration approach that I was discussing with Your Honor earlier, which is, again, the remedy that EPA itself devised to address a very similar type of problem where it was making decisions years after the fact. So I think either of those are options. I think the court should put the ball in the agency's court to make a decision, to make the decision, but it needs to do one of those two things because those are the only two things we can imagine that would actually mitigate the multi-hundred million dollar burden that the agency has imposed upon us by refusing to follow the law over and over again. All
right. Thank you, Mr. Keith.
Thank you.
Your case is under submission. Next case, Wynnewood Refining Company.